Hello, welcome to Worldview on Engelsberg Ideas. In each episode of these podcasts, we examine a key theme driving our world with access to the world's leading experts. We try to explore the past, present, and future. I'm Adam Bolton, and in this episode, we're going to look at how the world's geopolitics is changing shape, in particular reflecting on China and India, two countries both well-established as powerful superstates in the Indo-Pacific region, and of increasing interest to the Western alliance, not least following Russia's invasion and the ensuing war in Ukraine. A widely held view, in the West at least, is that President Putin is not just trying to regain territory he regards as belonging to Russia, but essentially attempting to destabilize the Western alliance of the United States, the United Kingdom, and Europe. So against this backdrop of world-shifting alliances, how do we assess the relative power and strength of China and India, their relationship to each other, and their intentions? Later on Worldview, I'm going to speak to two authorities on the modern development of India and China, Tanvi Madan of the Brookings Institute in Washington, D.C., and Rana Mitter, a historian of the Chinese Republic from Oxford University. First, I spoke to Peter Frankopan, Professor of Global History at the University of Oxford and author of a range of best-selling books, amongst them The Silk Road and A New History of the World. I asked Professor Frankopan first about his view that to historians, the present-day rise of China and the re-emergence of other Asian countries isn't something new, but a return to the patterns of the past.
I think it's just that when we think about the past in the West, we start with Athens and Greece. Maybe a sort of a quick nod to the pyramids, but it basically picks up with Athens and ancient Greece and then goes to Rome and then rolls forward. And that means that when we think about the rest of the world, we don't really know a great deal about places like Mesopotamia or the Indus Valley or the Yellow and Yangtze River civilizations, I mean, let alone Mesoamerica. So we don't pay a great deal of attention. So it means that our knowledge of other parts of the world, certainly in the historical narrative, is more or less non-existent. So all those bits where you hear about ancient Greek democracies, you know, we don't think about how cities were configured in other parts of the world that are much older than Greece and in fact have written cultures that predate Greece as well. So I think it's not about trying to take on all comers and say why we think wrong. It's I think widening the horizons and expansion, knowing the past doesn't mean you're going to be right about it, but it at least allows you to understand where people have come from. And I think we miss that in the way we have been trained in schools, universities and onwards.
So what do we need to know or should we know about India and China in their prehistory? Let's take as an arbitrary date, naught AD. What had happened and was happening in India and in China at that time?
Well, I'll paint a sort of bigger picture, I suppose, which is until about 1600, India and China, taken together, were by far the biggest, individually and together, by far the biggest economies in the world. And the reason they'd done that was because they were much more heavily populated, and that's still the case today. But until the colonial era, the great cities, civilizations, philosophers, scholars, they weren't all based in India and China. The Middle East and Persia were hugely important, and we chipped in a bit in Europe. But from that age of European empire, started, I suppose, with Columbus onwards, that sets Europe in a trajectory where in about 1400, Western Europe controls about 5% of the world's landmass. And then by 1900, Western Europe controls about 80% of the world's landmass. So I guess the starting point is for India and for China, the question that their scholars and philosophers have been thinking about for the last 200 years, and particularly for the last century, and above all, right now in the 21st century, is how was it that India and China could be so dominant in terms of their achievements, their economies, their social structures, and be overtaken by the West? And how does that era now flick back where the future is an Asian one? So the starting point of those discussions today in Beijing, in Delhi, and all the great cities of India and China is partly about the past, but it's also about how did it happen that those advances were lost? How was the lead that these civilizations and peoples had over the West in terms of medical care, astronomy, sciences, and so on? How were they overtaken? And what does the future now look like? I think the big picture here is that Asian century where two-thirds of the world's population more or less lives east of Istanbul is where all of the kind of nitty-gritties of what the world of today and tomorrow are going to be solved and worked out. And that creates opportunities, of course, for markets and growth. But also, you know, that's where climate change, the discussions are going to be most important, because however much we recycle in London or cities in England or, you know, Northern Europe, you know, the climate crisis is being forged by industrialization in particularly India and China, lots of other countries in Asia too. But the challenge is, how do these countries become richer and reach the same level of GDP per capita, same standards of living as we have? And how do they get there without burning the fuels that we burnt to get us up to our level? So I think that the interesting thing right now is, how do societies who feel that their past was taken away from them by colonialism, how do they come out the other side? And that anti-colonial discussion is quite similar today in India and in China. And it allows Modi and Xi to have a lot of common ground in the ways they're trying to think about problems. They solve them in different ways, but there's a lot of common ground there.
But if we go back to the pre-colonial period, how did China and India, if we can define them as those entities, how did they regard each other?
Well, they're separated by the Himalayas, which are extremely substantial and blocks most trade and exchange. And then by sea, the routes round are not straightforward. You know, to get from the Chinese coastline of today right the way round to India, you know, you have to run quite a long distance. So there was, you know, reasonable levels of trade, but not much going by land and not a huge amount by sea. Lots going through third parties of what's now Southeast Asia countries like Vietnam, Philippines, Indonesia, and so on. But the thing that does move in an interesting way is beliefs. And the most important of those is Buddhism, which sort of rises in what's now northern India, Nepal, around about the year 500-600 BC, depending on when one thinks the Buddha was alive. But Buddhism heads north through land routes, through the Silk Road, through Central Asia, and round into China from the west, and becomes not quite a state religion in China, but it's adopted and hugely significant in the development of Chinese thinking. And that has a real ambivalence as well around, you know, where do ideas come from and are they really India? I mean, your question, what really is China and what is India? Are these labels helpful? I mean, we'd prefer to talk about Chinese civilizations and Indian civilizations or South Asian civilizations, because the land borders of today don't bear any similarity to the land borders of any point in the past, let alone in antiquity. But those levels of exchange are not enormous, but India and China are both economic and social superpowers, partly because they are home to vast numbers of people, partly because vast numbers of people tend to concentrate in cities and towns, and cities and towns tend to, because there are lots of people living there, have lots of intensive exchanges. But the real connections between India and China in antiquity and to the modern period were never particularly intensive because of the challenges of geography.
And were either the Indian civilizations or the Chinese civilizations, were they expansionist in the way that the post-Columbus European powers clearly were?
I guess it's a slightly different question, which is, why do you expand? And the expansion by empires is normally either in order to knock out a military threat, you know, that's fairly logical, or because you want to push into regions that offer opportunities for higher levels of income, particularly if there are fantastic fields and agriculture, or if there are, you know, water sources, if there are things that can make you rich, or if there are civilizations next
door, minerals
that you can knock off, exactly, or things that you want. But in China's case, and for most of Chinese history, the big imperial dynasties were focused on the eastern coast into the center of China. But to the large extent of the western China, you, and to the north, you find the Gobi Desert, the Mongolian plains, and the steppes, which are vast. And there's not really a great deal of good stuff that you want there. But the purpose of expansion is always slightly different in the worlds of the Chinese civilizations and in those of India. So in China, the big expansion comes in the Qing dynasty. So in the middle of the 17th century, the Ming dynasty fell and was replaced by a new dynasty that had come from Manchuria, northern China, called the Qing. And they were the last dynasty that was in charge of what's now China, that from 1644 until the revolution of 1911, where the last emperor, Puyi, was dethroned. And that opened up the way for China to transition first to a republic and then under Mao into the communist state that is today. China today, for example, says that it's not a colonial power like the Europeans were. But in the Qing dynasty, China more or less doubled in size into roughly what its territorial size is today. But a lot of those expansions were vast tracts of land that didn't bring immediate gains. So expansion for its own sake is different to highly targeted, purposeful colonialism. And, you know, the Europeans, when Columbus set off across the Atlantic, he was heading west because he was sure that he would find India and China and be able to connect Spain into the markets and the peoples and the goods of Asia. In fact, he found the Americas and then came back writing letters saying, you know, we found vast gems and gold deposits, which wasn't true. But it turned out within the next 10, 15, 20 years that the Aztecs and then later the Inca did have minerals that were valuable, like particularly silver, but also the land and the terrain of the Caribbean and Southern America, Southern North America, you know, the south part of the United States, was ideal for growing things like sugar and tobacco and cotton, which are very labour intensive, but you then have to find people who will grow them. And so the Europeans then started to enslave people in Africa to do the backbreaking work. And so you expand for a purpose, and normally those motives are either military or they're economic. And the drivers for those kinds of expansion for Indian rulers and Chinese rulers were slightly different. There were one or two exceptions. The great Indian empire that I'm most interested in is the Chola, around about the year 1000, who expanded into what's now Southeast Asia towards Vietnam and so on. And then you do see moments of Indian culture looking outwards to see what other regions there are that there might be benefits from. But most expansion is, it's expensive to send armies and ships overseas. It's expensive to take the risk politically because they might get into trouble. So sort of willy-nilly expansion is different to calculated, thoughtful attempts to try to dominate other people because you're trying to take what they've got.
India, in its expansionism, Hinduism, did that expand outside of the country?
Yes, it did. I mean, you find these incredible sites like Angkor in what's now Cambodia, which is filled with blends of Hinduism along with Buddhism and other local beliefs, and the footprint of Hinduism heading eastwards. But I think one of the things about Hinduism is it's not a religion of evangelization, a bit like Judaism. You know, you can become Jewish, but Judaism is something that is given to you by your genes. Islam and Christianity spread as a factor of showing that you have the right true meaning, whereas Hinduism, it's a different sort of belief system that isn't a colonial one in the same way that evangelical religions are. So you find footprints of Hinduism all over Southeast Asia, but it doesn't make an enormous imprint going westwards, where there are competing belief systems that are quite adept at giving their own cosmological explanations of what's going on in the world. And Hinduism is a very complicated religion. You know, listeners who've tried to follow what the different manifestations of the Hindu deities will know that it's difficult and it's complicated because, if you were cynical, I suppose, you'd say because priests are quite incentivized to make things sound difficult and complicated because they're the only people who can understand them. So complicated religions don't tend to want to expand because they're certain of their own beliefs and the truth, and they wait for people to come to them.
Is it also the case that China quite consciously turned away from the outside world, you know, the famous injunctions or laws against people having ships or having to get them cleared through the dynasties if they wanted to travel?
Yeah, but that's a kind of slightly taking back control story. That's, you don't necessarily want to ban ships, as you want to control revenues. And the problem about when everybody sets off from the coast and comes back, you can't tell what they've got. So some of that is to do with control of trade. Some of that is to do with a view that the outside world doesn't really have anything that you want. And so when the British turn up in China in 1793, an embassy sent under Lord Macartney, there's a lot of discussion in London about whether the envoy should show submission to the Chinese emperor and kowtow and bow down and scrape on the floor. And eventually the Chinese pass a message back saying, we're not interested in a single thing that your country has to offer. And so if you are a great empire, you quite often think that, well, why would we want to have trade links with anybody else? What is it that you're going to possibly bring us that we don't already have? And those miscalculations, of course, in the long run, turned out to be probably not a great position for the Chinese to take, because the British and other colonial powers were quite adept at working out how to open the door for themselves and then pushing again and again and again. So in Britain's case, within about 50 years of being told to clear off and never come back, the British were able to force the Chinese to open up a set of ports on the coast to British traders. And then after that, in 1860, to not only force the concession over Hong Kong, but also British troops burnt down the Imperial Palace in the Forbidden City in Beijing, in Peking, as it was, Beijing. So the problem about seeing what you want to do with outsiders is, do you see outsiders as a threat? And, you know, for example, today in modern China, there are half as many Europeans living in China as there are in North Korea per capita. So there are twice as many Europeans per capita in North Korea than there are in China today, one of the largest economies in the world. And that, I think, is born of an anxiety of the outside world, a sort of xenophobia of being concerned that you're going to come a cropper and that other people have nefarious aims, that they're promising you one thing and then doing something else. And in China today, that period where their engagement with the West, and particularly with Britain, took off is known as a century of humiliation. And in fact, since the last 20 years, there's been a day of national humiliation in China, which is to remind citizens that this is how China and Chinese people suffered at the hands of outsiders. And that's sort of quite striking. If you think, you know, in Britain, we celebrate Trafalgar Day. We celebrate the days in which, you know, British armies and navies beat other people, and we celebrate great achievements. But so to celebrate a day and to commemorate a day where you're thinking about all the bad things that happened, it tells you, I think, quite a lot about the mentalities in the contemporary world about what the outside looks like.
India, by contrast, underwent the East India Company and active exploitation for 250 years, followed by the Raj. So how did India feel about the people who'd arrived to exploit it?
Well, it was slightly different in India. It's a hugely sensitive discussion amongst not just historians, but the general public as well, to evaluate. I mean, the British in India, you know, were not the only beneficiaries. There were local Indians who cooperated and did well from trade with Britain, including some who were poor and weren't owning, had control over assets. But it was nevertheless, you know, the purpose of the British in India was to extract things. It was to get goods out of India. And then eventually, towards the later part of the British rule, it was to sell things back to India. And, you know, that created a tricky balance now looking back on it around, was British rule on balance, did it bring anything good? What did it bring that was good? And to what extent were the British and colonial powers architects of India's, well, not misfortune, because, you know, India has been a glorious history and culture. But, you know, would India have developed in a slightly different way were it not for colonialism? And of course, the answer would be yes. But evaluating how that is tricky. But what's interesting is at the start of the 20th century, there were lots of discussions between Indian and Chinese intellectuals, and in fact later in the middle of the 20th century between political leaders, comparing the experiences of India and China, you know, under Western influences and what had come back from that. So people like Nehru, for example, talked about, who was the first Prime Minister of India after independence, said that India and China were sister nations who were born from the dawn of history together, now looking towards their freedoms. You know, colonialism and empires are always messy because the role of an empire is to extend its tentacles outwards and then drag everything to the centre to make those close to the centre richer, more stable and more prosperous. And of course, it's a very tricky sensation because you either cooperate or you get run over. And, you know, most people chose cooperation in some way, shape or form, but it wasn't necessarily voluntary.
Today, we have a perception of India and China as being rivals. They have border disputes. They appear to have different geopolitical goals. What would you regard as the sort of key points in the relationship between India and China over the centuries?
The most interesting thing is here and now today. And I think that the relationship is a nuanced and it's a complicated one. I mean, you're absolutely right. The headlines are that China and India are uncomfortable bedfellows. They might have had similar trajectories in some ways, but they regard each other with a degree of suspicion and antipathy. They see each other in lots of ways as rivals. You know, India, the largest democracy on earth, China, the most populated country on earth. But on the other hand, despite the fact that there is often a contentious and fractious relationship between the two, very little trade cooperation, lots of rivalries, the perception of China in India has been extremely negative for quite a long period of time. For the last 20 years, it's been highly negative. We in the West, only the last 3 or 4 years, we've suddenly woken up and become sort of quite concerned about what China's up to. But on the other hand, there are also lots of things that the two countries have in common, the most important of which is that the idea that we are moving into a multipolar age is meat and drink for Beijing and for Delhi, for Xi and for Modi. The narrative that the world is dominating control from Washington and the West as its sort of satellites is one that generates a great deal of nodding in lots of capitals around the world, particularly states in Asia. And that's been one of the signatures of this year with the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, where Lavrov in particular, but also Putin, has spoken repeatedly about the multipolar world and the need to end unipolarity. And the audience that they are looking for is not us in the West and in the United Kingdom, but it's at the Middle East and above all at India and at China. And so there is a transactional relationship for India and for China where both of these countries believe that their trajectories are quite similar, although there are specific and marked differences between them, and rivalry to the point of confrontation. And it's not just the Doklam Plateau. There's a great deal of rivalry in the maritime worlds around the coastline of India too.
And finally, what's your answer to the question you said that scholars and intellectuals in India and China are asking themselves, where did it all go wrong for them over the last 300 years or so? Or did it indeed all go wrong for them?
I'm very cautious about ever trying to sort of give the opinions of other people's. But I mean, I think that as a historian, history doesn't define what you're going to become, but it gives you a good narrative to explain why things are tricky. And I think in India and China, both leaderships have been quite smart to deploy history to say the reason why there are still people who are poor, the reason why we still have high maternal death rates, the reason why things aren't as good as they could be is because of other people. And, you know, that's not a million miles away from what Putin has worked out how to say. And it's not a million miles away from, I think, other countries in the world closer to home where we want to blame other people and other people's political decisions rather than thinking, how do we do that ourselves? And so the big challenge for Beijing and for Delhi is, you know, what is it that comes next? You know, what does India look like in 30 or 40 years' time? What does China look like in 30, 40 years' time? And it would look to me that the trajectory of these two enormous countries is one where the waves of the storm coming towards are worrying the leadership, and I'm probably not surprised.
Professor Peter Frankopan there with some advice to respect and take China and India seriously. Well, joining me now is Tanvi Madan, who's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute in Washington, D.C., director of its India program and author of the book Fateful Triangle, How China Shaped India-US Relations During the Cold War. I began by asking her to outline those relations between India and China at the end of the Second World War.
Both in India and China, coming out of a process where they'd all both been involved in the war, had supplied men, materiel, and other kinds of support, had been the site of conflict as well. But the other conflict that had been going on was that you had a civil war in China that was still underway, and in India, a process leading to decolonization, where India was 2 years away from gaining its independence, while China was 4 years away from becoming the People's Republic of China, with Chiang Kai-shek going to Taiwan, of course, and that civil war in some ways continuing through, even as the West was going through a process where the Cold War was unfurling, you saw these two Asian giants emerge from a very different perspective, not just having to engage with the world, which was undergoing kind of this polarization and bipolarity, but themselves trying to form new nations as such.
And both of them undergoing very radical political change. Obviously, with independence came partition in India, and in China, the assertion of a new communist regime.
Yes, and two governments that looked at each other with some kind of both suspicion, but at the same time, also a sense of Asianism. So you had this brief period between the two countries of kind of an Asia for Asian sentiment, particularly after the Korean War, which was another thing just after India gained independence and the People's Republic was formed. Both countries were involved in very different ways, of course. China, very much part of the war, one of the belligerents, and India on its part, getting involved through being its one of its first kind of mediating efforts, where it chaired the Neutral Nations Repatriation Committee. So very different from later on in the Cold War, where India wasn't really thought about being involved in East and Southeast Asia, but very much of a sentiment of a larger Asia that was emerging from a time of both war and colonialism. and trying to kind of establish their own identities as nations and as geopolitical actors.
And what was the aim of the United States and its allies? I mean, how were they meddling in India and indeed in China at this stage?
I'm not sure I'd use the word meddling as such, but you saw two developments really kind of bring this region into American focus. One was the People's Republics of China being founded, so the communist takeover of China from the Chinese nationalists led by Chiang Kai-shek, and in 1950, the Korean War, and when that started. And that did see this region, this kind of region of South Asia and Southeast and East Asia, being seen through a Cold War U.S.-Soviet competition prism. At the other end of Asia, what in fact many in South Asia still call West Asia and what we often call the Middle East, you did see a different kind of interest that did touch at least India, not China so much, where the other aspect of this area being seen through the prism of the Second World War was that the U.S. and Britain saw this region through a Middle East lens in the context of the Cold War, an oil-rich region which had become crucial in keeping the militaries fueled up during the Second World War, needing to preserve Western access to that oil. And therefore, countries like Pakistan in particular become important to these countries. The U.S. had first reached out to India for some sort of Pacific Pact, to be a member of the Pacific Pact, or even work together in the Middle East. India had not been interested. And so, facilitated by Britain, the U.S. took an interest, at least in Pakistan, because of Middle East interest. What, in hindsight, the West perhaps took, and particularly the U.S., of course, Britain was involved in this as an imperial power, as were the French, but the U.S. perhaps took nationalism less seriously than they should have and saw through things, even nationalist movements that were fighting against imperialism, they saw that through the lens of the Cold War. And so basically, you were either communist or non-communist or anti-communist.
We've talked about this in the framework of the Cold War, but what about Russia, or rather the Soviet Union, the USSR? What was it doing in the region?
For the Soviets, the Chinese were a partner, and China was very much the junior partner at the time. And so you did have a kind of a Sino-Soviet partnership, if not alliance, part of the communist bloc, of course. Vis-a-vis India, it was actually quite interesting, even though kind of India-Soviet relations became much talked about later in the initial years after Indian independence. Stalin particularly saw India with some skepticism. He thought of the Indian leadership as bourgeois, as very much kind of allied with the West, that had fought with the West in the Second World War, or kind of under the kind of allied guise. He saw the kind of Indian leadership as not kind of socialist or communist enough. And he didn't think about leaders like Nehru or Patel, who was the deputy prime minister, as having much agency, and thought that essentially countries like India would be, who were not communist, and even though they were not allied with the West, Stalin saw them as essentially too Western, too bourgeois. And so even though he started to change his mind because of India's independent position on the Korean War, it was only after Stalin's death in 1953 that you saw Khrushchev and Bulganin think about India differently. You see the Soviets really go on a charm offensive, an economic offensive, as American officials saw it at the time, in around 1955, where today what we would call the Global South, they made a big push for. They appealed, they saw kind of the non-aligned or the neutrals as an opportunity, and not as an obstacle as the West was seeing them at the time. And so you saw kind of in a Soviet-India relationship developing, a partnership, mostly economic, with big kind of Soviet infrastructure projects. While you did see a Sino-Soviet relationship that was quite deep, it had some frustrations.
And then it ruptured in the early 60s.
Yes, it did. In fact, it started rupturing earlier. People at the time didn't know that till much later. But you started seeing signs of kind of tension in the relationship. And interestingly, this is something India watched very closely, because initially the Soviets facilitated, it was in Moscow's interest to see that Asia for Asians phenomena take place because it meant that India wouldn't ally with the West. So they facilitated a closed Delhi-Beijing relationship. But as Sino-Indian tensions started to rise about 1956, 1957, you start to see kind of a Moscow that starts becoming a little bit worried about India-China tensions. And in India that suddenly, after having seen the Sino-Soviet partnership as an asset, starts to worry about China-Soviet relations at the time. And indeed, one of the causes, one of the things that exacerbated Sino-Soviet tensions was Khrushchev's unhappiness about the way China handled the India-China border dispute, because that border dispute eventually resulted in a war between India and China, which leaves a legacy to this day. And what Moscow worried about, and they were right in that instance, is that a India-China war would push India towards the West, and particularly the US. And during the Cold War, it did indeed result in a very close India-US partnership with the US assistance to India during the China-India War in 1962.
Do you feel that what's happened in Europe with Russia going from threats and claims to invading a neighbouring country, what impact has that had on the thinking of China and India?
What India worries about is that Moscow will do what it did in the 1962 war. The Soviets at the time not just stalled the supply of fighter aircraft to India, but provided the Chinese both diplomatic support internationally and intelligence in India. This, for Indian policymakers today, continues to be a nightmare, particularly because it is far more dependent on Russian military supplies today than it was in 1962. Indian concern that its partners, like the US, would kind of take away their attention from the Indo-Pacific theater and be focused far more, including in terms of resources and attention, on Europe. And for India today, those partners, whether it's the US, Australia, France, Japan, these are crucial partners as it tries to balance a rising China.
Yeah, I was going to say that's the plus for India, is that the West, including the US and the UK, are very anxious to identify India as an ally, aren't they?
There's a difference between how the US and UK perhaps, or how much convergence there is with India on this. India and the US have far more convergence on perceptions of China than perhaps India and the UK do. For just geographic reasons, the US is a far bigger player in the Indo-Pacific. The US, along with its allies, can help shape a favorable balance of power in the region to deter China more broadly. For India, it sees the US as crucial in ensuring that a multipolar Asia prevails and not a unipolar Asia dominated by China. And so you really do see between the US and India the strategic convergence, which is not only driven by their shared concerns about China, but in large part, that shared concern about China has been driving them to a deeper defense and security relationship, but is also giving both sides incentives to manage their differences, whether over Russia, whether over Pakistan, whether over trade.
Tanvi Madan on navigating the alliances in the Indo-Pacific region. Joining me now is Rana Mitter, who is the Professor of History and Politics of Modern China at St. Cross College, University of Oxford. As we've already heard, China and India are both looking towards a more multipolar world. So where exactly do they stand today?
The two countries really have very different domestic politics. India, in some ways, is a very inward-looking set of political priorities. It's to do with the difficulties of trying to keep balance in a federalized system where the central government has increasing levels of control, particularly under the current Hindu nationalist government of Narendra Modi, but where the politics of the region have their own very distinctive flavors. And foreign affairs, while they're important, particularly when it comes to the twin neighbor, you might say, created in 1947 at independence, and that's Pakistan, of course, always sits in the consciousness of Indian decision makers. Nonetheless, questions of India's economy, domestically speaking, its secular balance between secular and religious, and its domestic politics are really much more urgent questions. China, to to some extent, at least in official terms, doesn't have that kind of internal division, because the nature of an authoritarian one-party state is that it doesn't acknowledge that there are these actual differences within even a very large country. But also China is much more explicit about the way that its domestic politics is tied to a growing sense of international presence, and things like China being at the center of many international supply chains. And while there are some parallels with India, in a sense, they're not quite as extensive or quite as notable.
And how do they regard each other? It's often portrayed as an increasingly competitive relationship, almost a confrontation.
For a long time, you could argue that India spent a long time deeply concerned and worrying about China, and China spent a great deal of time thinking about India almost not at all. I don't think that was ever entirely true, and I think it's less true now, but it's certainly the case that they don't sit equally in each other's minds. The question of China's growing presence in Asia has become a major issue for India, broadly speaking. And some of the responses that India is making, particularly in terms of its external defense, are causing more concern in China than would have been the case previously. The major point of contention between them, which still sits very, very extensively in the minds of Indian decision makers, even though Chinese only tend to think of it sporadically, was the war 60 years ago in 1962 in the border areas, where the pushback and the violence that occurred in 1962 in that border war has continued to shape and in some ways poison the relationship between the two sides. It's never really been terribly friendly ever since then. And I think off the back of that, we can see that there's a wider sense that India feels that a growing Chinese presence in places like the Indian Ocean, where China's new trading and indeed military capacity can be projected, is forcing India to think about China more as a geopolitical East regional rival, and encouraging India to think more in ways that it might not have done a generation ago, such as in its arrangement known as the Quad, where it teams up for naval exercises with Australia, Japan, and the United States. So you could say that perhaps the two of them are becoming geopolitical competitors, but they're not equal competitors. India is more interested in holding its own, you might say. China is more interested in actually shaping itself into a country that has real influence across Asia, even in places where right now it's not the most influential actor.
Yet neither of them have lined up with the sort of traditional Western world order when it comes to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, for example.
That's right. But the reasons for that are different in each case. Neither India nor China voted to condemn Russia in the United Nations General Assembly vote early on in the conflict in I think, March of 2022. In the case of China, this was perhaps less surprising. Just a few weeks before, on the 4th of February 2022, at the Beijing Winter Olympics, Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin appeared together declaring that they had a friendship without limits. And it's very clear that in terms of a variety of areas, including some joint military exercises, economic partnership, Chinese purchase of fossil fuels from Russia, those sorts of areas, the two have become very close and are acting both overtly and covertly in some sorts of cooperation. Yet even there, we should point out, there is a red line. China recognizes perfectly well that when Russia invaded Ukraine, it broke an international red line, the invasion of another internationally recognized country, which China certainly recognizes Ukraine as being. And so that did lead to an abstention rather than a condemnation in the UN. But it didn't ruin the overall feeling between Xi and Putin that they had business that they could do with each other. The India story is somewhat different. It goes back, in a sense, to the Cold War. India was unusual in being one of the very few full democracies during the Cold War that sided much more, not sided, but at least had sympathies for the Soviet Union under the wider policy of coexistence and neutrality. And India's relationship with the US was often quite fraught for that reason. But as a result of that policy, a few geopolitically slightly odd things happened, perhaps the oddest of which was that over the decades, India has become very reliant on Russia for armaments. And that means that it became geopolitically rather impractical for India to condemn Russia. I think it's still fair to say that the relationship that India has with Russia is in some ways problematic, and it's looked, for instance, to diversify its supply of armaments. But having said that, India does not want its foreign policy to be dictated by the United States or by any of the countries which sit in the democratic world. And by keeping that relationship with Russia still quite active, Russia remains grateful because it hasn't got that many friends left in the world at the moment. But India also feels that it can maintain that idea that dates back to the first independence prime minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, of India ploughing its own path and its own distinct path in international affairs.
And you mentioned the fact that there are border tensions between the two countries. What would likely be India's reaction were China to move against Taiwan? I don't know whether you think that's likely or not.
Well, first of all, there's a separate set of questions we won't go into depth at this moment about what China's move against Taiwan might be, because to summarise very briefly, I think most analysts right now would suggest that an all-out military D-Day style invasion is actually pretty unlikely for a variety of reasons, equipment, topography and so forth. Something like a naval blockade, not involving a direct, you know, firing on the coastline, but making it very difficult for military or civilian shipping to come in and out through the waters around Taiwan, is perhaps more of a possibility in a certain number of years' time. But again, these are questions being weighed up in Beijing and elsewhere. So the question has to be slightly adapted to what would India's reaction be to a spectrum of situations relating to Taiwan. I think in the majority of cases, I'm speaking very broadly here, I am not sure that India would regard a Chinese attempt to change the status of Taiwan to essentially bring it, you know, into incorporation with China as being an existential issue for India. I don't think that's true of other Asian countries. I think that Japan has already made it clear that it would find that an extremely dangerous outcome, and even South Korea and countries in the more immediate Southeast Asian, East Asian sphere would, I think, find that very, very problematic. Singapore would be another one of those. India is further away, and India is more concerned essentially with its own regional penumbra. So I think that Taiwan is one of those questions. Certainly, I think India would not wish China to take Taiwan. It has good relations with Taiwan on its own. It would also be concerned, as the rest of the world would, with the sudden destruction of the world's most important supply of semiconductor chips, which, of course, are very important for India's increasingly strong tech sector. But I think one of the many reasons that India has always stayed away from formal alliances, the Quad I mentioned before is not an alliance, it's an agreement, is that it does not want to be sucked into regional or indeed global conflicts on terms that are anything other than the ones that have been decided by India's own leadership and indeed quite possibly electorate.
It is often said that China is the world's greatest dictatorship or autocracy of some kind, and that India is the world's greatest democracy or largest democracy. Are either of those fair descriptions?
I think the answer is that greatness for a country lies in what it is capable of doing that brings something positive to the rest of the world. And I think it's fair to say that in both cases, there are things that you can see that both bring and both have major flaws. I think if you had to come up with something, and goodness knows the Chinese are always trying to press us to see the positive side of things, there is a story that exists in China, and it's a real story, and it can't be entirely gainsaid, I think, that it was an immensely poor country 40 to 45 years ago, and now it is a middle-income country. It has a per capita GDP of $10,000 per year. India has a per capita GDP of around $3,500 a year. That's less than half as much on a population about the same size. There may be many reasons, not all of them to China's immediate advantage that it's managed to become so much richer, but we can also say it's not nothing. It's not nothing. That is an important story, and poverty alleviation is a story that China tells around the world and has, I think, some authority to tell. What China also implies, or sometimes states, which personally I think is mistaken, is the idea that in some ways democratic and consensual decision-making is an obstacle to that kind of poverty reduction. And in fact, there are lots of other countries which tend to be cited less, even if they're less populous than China, which have actually gone through the process both of enrichment and democratization, South Korea and indeed Japan earlier on being two very good Asian examples. So I think that in those terms, you can see both what the pluses and the minuses of China's view of the world is. Turn to India. I mean, again, being able to maintain yourself as a broadly pluralist electoral democracy since independence in 1947 is a really important achievement. It is relatively rare. When I say that, I don't just mean in terms of non-Western countries, because you have to remember that actually through large parts of the time that India has been a multi-party electoral democracy ever since 1947, lots of countries that now sit at the heart of the West were not democracies. Spain was not a democracy until 1975. Portugal was not a democracy until the same year. Greece went between democracy and military coups in the 1960s and 70s. Throughout all of that period, India continued to hold general elections on a regular basis. It too briefly abandoned democracy between 1975 and 77 when Mrs. Gandhi declared an emergency, so-called, which basically gave her arrogated powers to herself. But even she had to hold an election, which she then lost, which again is really quite an achievement for India's democracy. Today, the democracy is real, but is much less liberal than it used to be and is much more shaped by religious practice. These are all worrying trends, but they don't necessarily act against the reality that maintaining a multi-party federalized system, which has lots of political possibility in it, is something that is relatively rare, very, very important, and is completely different from the top-down sort of organization that China has had under its authoritarian system for many decades.
And often, I think, when you ask the question, what do India or China want from the West, the answer was not much. Has that changed today?
I think that there are things that come from the Western world that are still of great interest to China and India for related, if somewhat different reasons. If I had to pin down one, I would say that it's always been the case that the world of education is one where India and China have gained a great deal from being involved with the West, not least because even now, many of the great centres of scientific development and also of liberal study have, for historic reasons, been based in Western centres, in Paris, in New York, in London. That is beginning to shift. The fact is, for a long time, one of the reasons why India and indeed China's educational establishments have not had more of a capacity to attract people from around the world is that they were relatively poor. But that situation with economic growth is beginning to change. The issue which is much more visibly at the feet of China and India today, and which is entirely in their hands, is a question of how long the liberal underpinning of their public spheres and therefore their education systems are going to be. As China is increasingly showing, you can have some of the richest universities in the world, and actually the scientific research that comes out of Tsinghua, Peking University, and the other great institutions there is a world-class standard when it comes to artificial intelligence, quantum computing, a whole variety of areas. But in a whole variety of areas, and perhaps most appallingly, Chinese history is one of them. China is not the best place in the world to study Chinese history. The simple reason being that large parts of that history, including the history of the Chinese Communist Party itself, cannot be freely studied in China. Unless you can have that kind of freedom, you can't have a truly great history department. Now, traditionally, India has allowed more space for its own historians and liberal scholars to debate and discuss India's history, and that's not gone by any means. But there's no doubt that the emergence of a more nationalist government in the last 10 to 15 years has made it much harder for that liberal, pluralist part of the education system to thrive. It's not gone yet, but it is much more in danger than it seemed to be a few years ago. And if India doesn't want to go down the way of China in terms of basically the state telling historians what to do, then it would be well advised to remember that actually in taking the center of gravity in those areas away from the Western world towards India and towards China is to allow as free and as liberal an exploration of those historical issues as possible.
How do you read Chinese expansionism into the South China Seas, or indeed perhaps the Belt and Road Initiative?
The expansion of the South China Sea, just a reminder to listeners, is something that actually has been underway for decades, even before the communists came to power. And it certainly kind of got a rocket boost after World War II in the late 1940s under the old nationalist government, who essentially wished to argue very strongly that they were the rightful controllers of large swathes of the seas around China, not just the usual sort of relatively limited offshore areas, but large swathes of the open sea. There's no doubt that in the early 21st century, China has moved much faster than in any previous iteration into essentially creating not facts on the ground, but facts in the sea. you might say. In other words, small islands essentially getting military installations, small populations, and also the rejection of the judgment of the International Court at The Hague in 2016 that said that Chinese claims on all of those seas, which were brought by the Philippines against China, that the court said that the Chinese claims essentially didn't stand up, and China basically said, well, we reject the court in that case. I think there's no doubt that essentially Chinese attempts to militarize large parts of the South China Sea have, in their own terms, been pretty successful. It's now harder for other actors in the region, Vietnam, Philippines, Indonesia, and US allies, to have the level of free passage that they had before. But for the moment, there's a sort of uneasy standoff between Chinese claims that everything there is theirs and the insistence of other actors, including US and US allies, to continue to operate freedom of navigation exercises with ships going through the region. The Belt and Road Initiative is very different, I think. Clearly, the story that's emerged in recent years that's troubled people is of Chinese lending going to projects that haven't worked out and huge amounts of debt being shoveled onto the shoulders of taxpayers in places like Sri Lanka. And certainly there are cases of that sort. But overall, I think most of the examination of the Belt and Road Initiative broadly defined, in other words, the idea of bringing large sums of development money from China to the wider world, it's sort of a wash, you might say, by which I mean it kind of, there's a bit that works okay and quite a bit that doesn't work okay. And it's difficult to actually come up with a major pattern between the two. I think the most interesting story, actually, which has been rather underestimated, is that the Belt and Road Initiative in the old sense, meaning the first 10 to 15 years of existence, doesn't exist anymore. It basically consisted of China using large amounts of unallocated capital being placed through slightly opaque development banks to go for projects that couldn't find funders elsewhere. But by the end of last year, I think China's leaders, who are basically paying for the development bank, realized that large numbers of them were going to projects that weren't making any money. So now a great deal of the so-called Belt and Road Initiative is actually private sector Chinese enterprise in areas such as 5G, vaccine development, green energy. And it's much more being put on the shoulder of Chinese private sector enterprises, who, while they are, of course, heavily influenced by the Communist Party in the state, make no mistake about that, they also have shareholders, they have stock market valuations, and they can't simply pour money into useless projects in the way that did happen with some of the Belt and Road Initiative projects. So actually, we're really in the world of BRI version 2.0 these days, and we have to see whether that's going to be any more effective than the predecessor, which, as I say, has some success stories to offer and some failures, but isn't probably either the apocalyptic shift in terms of Chinese influence that some people said, nor is it the debt-ridden disaster that destroyed China's reputation as its opponents would like to put forward.
I think both regimes have welcomed the idea of a multipolar world, moving away from American hegemony, perhaps, or Western hegemony. How significant do you think that's going to be in practical terms in the current decades, this century?
I think a version of multipolarity is coming whether people like it or not, and in some senses both India and China talking about it is an acknowledgement of the obvious. I think in some ways, particularly for China, perhaps even more than India, it's a way of saying multipolarity means that Washington doesn't get to tell everyone what to do in a way that they would have said they perhaps did something like 30 years ago. I think both, though, would acknowledge that there is something else that, for the moment, is less openly spoken but hard to avoid. And that is that multipolarity does not mean equal multipolarity. China is much more powerful. It's certainly, I think, by any standards, plausibly the number two nation state in the world after the United States in terms of military and economic power. But that doesn't mean that Chinese power is equal to that of the United States. The United States is still, for the moment, the single most powerful actor in the world. And it does that because, in the end, it has the biggest economy in the world. It's still the most innovative country in the world in terms of technology. Yes, China's catching up in various ways, but Silicon Valley still outstrips anywhere else on Earth, not just China, broadly speaking. The world still uses the dollar as the reserve currency of the globe. They often hate doing it, but they'll do it. And there are still young people around the world growing up who really, really, really desperately want to go to the United States. There are many good reasons to want to go to China, but I think that for the moment, the widespread desire of aspirational youth in many parts of the global South, much though they may admire China's achievements in terms of economics, they're not, for the most part, aspiring to go to China and blend into the system. And in the case of India, while India has many aspirations, I think most of them are quite domestically focused. India is not, I think, looking for the kind of global role that China would like to have. Multipolarity might refer to a particular division of a type of geopolitical hard power, who's got the most nuclear weapons, who can invade where, all those sorts of things. But it ignores a great deal of the other wider sets of phenomena that means that the United States, for good or ill, is still a very, very different proposition in global terms from China, India, or even the EU or the UK.
That was Rana Mitter. So having looked at India and China from their ancient civilization through the colonization period and the Second World War into the Cold War and to today, let's get some final thoughts from Rana Mitter, Tanvi Madan and Peter Frankopan. Where are these great civilizations, India and China, heading in the 21st century?
The US, along with its allies, can help shape a favorable balance of power in the region to deter China more broadly. You really do see between the US and India the strategic convergence, which is not only driven by their shared concerns about China, but in large part, that shared concern about China has been driving them to a deeper defense and security relationship, but is also giving both sides incentives to manage their differences, whether over Russia, whether over Pakistan, whether over trade.
Multipolarity might refer to a particular division of a type of geopolitical hard power, who's got the most nuclear weapons, who can invade where, all those sorts of things. But it ignores a great deal of the other wider sets of phenomena that means that the United States, for good or ill, is still a very, very different proposition in global terms from China, India, or even the EU or the UK.
The big challenge for Beijing and for Delhi is, you know, what is it that comes next? You know, what does India look like in 30 or 40 years' time? What does China look like in 30 or 40 years' time? And it would look to me that China in particular, right now as we speak, is pretty nervous about what the next 10 or 15 years has in store. And India, I think, are watching to work out whether they should decide whether this is a moment of opportunity or whether it's time to batten down the hatches. The trajectory of these two enormous countries is one where the waves of the storm coming towards are worrying the leadership, and I'm probably not surprised.
Tanvi Madan, Rana Mitter and Peter Frankopan. This is Worldview for Engelsberg Ideas, funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. The producer was Murray Jessel, assistant producer Eve Webster, and sound engineer Gareth Jones. I'm Adam Bolton. Until next time, thanks for listening.